The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So those who are familiar with us will know, and those of you who are not familiar with us might not know, that Shasta Abbey, this monastery we're in, is a temple of the order of Buddhist contemplatives, which is comprised of two monasteries and many priories and small temples scattered over North America and Europe, mostly in the UK, and all its monks, lay ministers, and those who practice with us. Now, one of the things that drew me to the order of Buddhist contemplatives to become a monk is the word contemplative in the title. Over the years, I often wonder what this word means. What does it mean to be a Buddhist contemplative? And if we're contemplatives, what implications does that have for how we practice and how we live our lives? When we consider the contemplative, the first thing that comes to mind for many of us is meditative versus active, contemplative versus engaged. Contemplatives aren't busy, right? They meditate. Meditation practices a turning within and doing something about ourselves. Activity looks outward and attempts to change the world. We sometimes think of this as being versus doing. You know, I'd like to go somewhere and just be for a while. This distinction's reinforced by the history of Buddhism in the West. When Buddhism first entered our awareness in the 60s and 70s, what we were drawn to was meditation practice. And often we measured our worth as practitioners by how much time we could spend in meditation, engaged in meditative activities, in long retreat, that kind of fierce meditation practice, attending intensive retreats, that kind of thing. But then we noticed that this was hard to do in the midst of marriage and children and family and jobs and careers and all the other kinds of things we love to do with our lives, which we cherish. And we began to emphasize meditation in daily life and the practice of mindfulness, being mindful, being in the mind of meditation no matter what we were doing. Then, as our practice enabled the development of loving kindness and the bodhisattva vow to save all beings before we saved ourselves entered our awareness, we noticed that, argued that, the teachings of the Buddha support what came to be known as engaged Buddhism. And to this day, we still argue over which is more important, meditation or social action. And if the two don't stand together, if the two don't stand against each other, how do we appropriately balance them in our lives? My master once gave a talk in which he explained that the reason that we don't do engaged Buddhism here or engage in social action here at Shasta Abbey or in the order is that any cause, however noble, that one takes a stand for excludes someone. While it might seem obvious that it's a good thing to do to feed the homeless, there are those who would disagree. Then those people don't come or feel that they can't come or don't belong to our church, our monastery, or our temple. And he was clear that a church or temple must include everyone and exclude no one. Everybody's included. Everyone must feel that they can come and are welcome, that there's a place for them. This is part of why Shasta Abbey doesn't engage in social action or consider itself a part of engaged Buddhism. Though I might add that engaged Buddhism is a redundancy, for how can you be a Buddhist and not be engaged, totally and completely engaged with what is right before you in this very moment, in this present moment? So this is perhaps the first and most obvious issue that we run up against when we investigate what it means to be a contemplative order. What is our relationship with activity? Ordinarily, we think of a contemplative as someone who, at least somewhat, isolates themselves from the rest of the world and spends a lot of time in meditation and prayer. And that this has to do with religious practice. Some sense of, or knowing of, or experience of the numinous. I think the term a religious contemplative would strike us as an oxymoron, a contradiction in terms. So we're talking about something that has to do with religious life. In reflecting on this, I myself find that there are five qualities or aspects which I associate with the life of a contemplative. And it happens that they all start with S. So we have the five S's. Silence, stillness, solitude, simplicity, and space. Silence, stillness, solitude, simplicity, and space. So I'd like to talk about these a little bit, explore them. Silence, of course, is the absence of noise. It's also the absence of chatter, talking, and conversation. Sometimes it can, in a monastic setting or in a retreat setting, it can include a vow of silence, taking a vow of silence. Silence, to me, involves right relationship to mental chatter, which means that mental chatter, when we sit down to meditate, doesn't necessarily disappear, as you probably all have noticed, but that we don't engage with it. Right relationship to mental chatter is not engaging with it. And not engaging is perhaps the secret to silence. But if engagement is what Buddhism is, as I just said, engaged Buddhism is a redundancy, what do we mean by not engaging? We mean not grasping after or pushing away. That old familiar, don't grasp, don't push away. Not arguing with what is. That's not engaging. Skillful engagement is being totally aware of and present to, one with whatever is right here, right now. If we're engaged in this way, noise can become silence. Now, listening is the supreme silence. And I'm going to tell you a story that I told you the last time I talked in this room, the story of Mother Teresa, who was asked by a reporter, you can see how much I love this story. She was asked by a reporter what she says when she prays to God. And she said, nothing, I listen. So the reporter asked her the obvious question, what does God say to you? And she said, nothing, he listens. And I think that that type of listening, one being listening to another, is the supreme silence. The Sharingama Sutra also has, I'm not going to go into all of this, but listening, in the Sharingama Sutra, listening is voted as the best method to realization, to enlightenment. What do we hear when we listen? Listen to listening. I'd like to suggest that listening is the most important activity of a contemplative. I'll come back to that. Stillness. Stillness is the absence of movement and activity. So it's not quite the same as silence, which is the absence of noise. Now, there's the stillness of meditation practice in which we actually sit physically still. Sitting physically still helps you to notice how much your mind is moving. But there's a part of the mind that isn't moving that is also sitting still. And the stillness of meditation practice in which body and mind and heart are still is crucial and fundamental to everything that we do in our practice here. But we also speak of stillness in activity. The still point at the center, like a top spinning, you know, the center of the top is still and everything around it is moving. All stillness contains the seed of activity within it. And meditation ultimately enjoins us to action. You know, if you sat too long, you'd eventually have to get up and go to the restroom, if nothing else. Our practice shows us that stillness is possible amidst chaos and horror when grasping and pushing away are dropped off. If we drop off grasping and pushing away, stillness is possible amidst chaos and horror. Within whatever is happening, there is the seed of stillness. And it depends upon and it supports complete trust in the way things are. If we don't trust how things are, we can't sit still. And obviously, silence and stillness reinforce each other. Solitude. For progress on the spiritual path, I can't overestimate the value of time alone. I was going to say we monks discovered this, but maybe we already knew it when we were fortuitous enough to come into having two hermitages where we could do solitary retreat, and we found how valuable that was to our training and practice. So time alone is a good thing for our spiritual development. Aloneness, with a capital A, is to be distinguished from loneliness. In it, there's no sense of emptiness or incompleteness or bereftness. That's emptiness with a small e. The unborn is always with us. And we can know that. We can hear it. We can listen and hear it when we're alone. Aloneness is a complete trust that all that we need can be found within. We do not need to go outside because we're mirrors of the whole universe, in fact. When we truly accept and come to terms with our aloneness, we're most able to be intimate with others. So aloneness brings us back into relationship. Now, some contemplatives, you know, official contemplatives, live in enclosed communities. You know, we have an enclosure here. That half of the monastery is reserved for monks so that they can live privately. Did you all see Into the Great Silence? Into Great Silence? A movie, a lovely movie that documents the life of some Cistercian or Carthusian monks in the French Alps. And they live in silence. They live mostly in their cells. They take their meals mostly in their cells. So they live alone. They live in silence. They live in enclosure. No one comes and goes. Once a week, they go out for a walk and talk to each other. It's really lovely to see. And of course, they do their monastic hours together. The singing is beautiful. And as I said, they live in enclosure. Half of our monastery is enclosed. Enclosure provides solitude and also separation from the world. The enclosure can be the meditation hall, your room, half the monastery, a retreat hermitage, your car, your cubicle at work. But the ultimate enclosure is your own heart. It's the most important enclosure. As one writer put it, the heart of the matter, the heart of the practice of enclosure, is the guarding of one's heart in the communal pursuit of purity and ultimately of the vision of God. Now, that was written by a Christian, but you can translate that into Buddhist terms. We protect our heart that we might be pure, loving, and know the unborn. The vision of the divine, the numinous, the being of Buddha. Simplicity. A natural outcome of silence, solitude, stillness is simplicity. To my mind, it arises naturally from them. And it arises as we let go of desire and lust. Abandoning fame and gain, training to get somewhere or be somebody, renunciation. Renunciation, true renunciation, is not some kind of unpleasant ascetic practice. It's continuously letting go. Continuously letting go, no matter what, making no exceptions. Letting go of desire and lust, abandoning fame and gain. Letting go of training to be somebody. Letting go, no matter what, making no exceptions. So, simplicity, it's lacking clutter. Clutter is maybe the opposite of simplicity. And clutter obstructs silence, solitude, and stillness. We can think about what we really need in our lives and what we really need to be doing. Simplicity shows itself. Space. The word contemplative, it turns out, is derived from roots which mean to create a sacred space or something like that. I'm giving you the simplified version. Space gives us room to be, to see, to listen. A couple of years ago, seems like a couple of months ago, I gave a Dharma talk in which I proposed that space might be a synonym for enlightenment. Space is that important. And it could be true. Because with space, with non-contraction, unrestricted, unconstricted, you know, the sense of room, there's emptiness. This is emptiness with a capital E, shunyata. And within emptiness, within empty space, the numinous appears, the divine appears, Buddha appears. That which we most strenuously long for and which is our heart's truest wish. And I promise you that this is so. Now, these five conditions or aspects of the contemplative life, silence, stillness, solitude, simplicity, spaciousness, obviously, as you can see, reinforce and support each other. And each of the five is interwoven with the other four. What they create is the container for the listening that I've been talking about, the listening to listening. What a contemplative does is listen very deeply to that which is listening, to that which is listening. Within silence, within stillness, within solitude, simplicity, and spaciousness. So then, what does a contemplative come to know and experience and realize, that is, make so, with their whole being? Interestingly, the dictionary definition of contemplation is a form of prayer or meditation which passes beyond concepts, so we're beyond the thinking mind, the intellect, the analytical mind, to a direct experience of the divine. And again, we can translate that into Buddhist terms. A contemplative is someone who does this, meditates or prays in such a way as to move beyond concepts and directly experience Buddha-ness, if I can put it that way. I think at this point, at least for me, there's little distinction between the contemplative and the mystic. Now, last winter when I was in England, I had the joy and privilege of visiting a meditation group there, and we did a day-long retreat. And during one of the discussions, somebody asked me to choose one word that would distill Buddhism down into one word. And I was pretty flummoxed by this question. My mind sort of stopped. You know how it does that sometimes? And nothing came to mind. I mean, Buddhism in one word, and, you know, me the talker. Anyway, the word I settled on was stillness. Now, I don't think that's too bad a choice, but as I think about it and as I've reflected on it since, the word that I would choose today is non-duality. If I had to distill Buddhism into one word, non-duality. Some of you know that Reverend Alethea is dying, and we've been sitting with her, and she's asked us to read a Zen poem to her, one by Kanchi Sosan that you can find in Buddhist writings, that which is engraved upon the heart that trusts to the eternal. And it's been really a joy to read this poem to her because it's very profound. And it's wonderful to share this with her. It begins, "The way to the ultimate is not hard. Simply give up picking and choosing. Just by not giving in to hatred and craving, will your heart and mind be as clear and bright as the realm beyond the opposites. Let but a hair's breadth of discriminatory thought arise, and you have made heaven and earth strangers to each other. Your mind will be as clear and bright as the realm beyond the opposites. But if the discriminatory mind arises, heaven and earth become strangers to each other. Dogen says, when the opposites arise, the Buddha mind is lost. What the contemplative knows and live, and where the contemplative lives is within non-duality. It's not a matter of meditation versus social action, or activity versus stillness, or silence versus noise, or inside versus outside, or lay versus monastic, or anything else you can come up with like that, heaven and earth. It's a matter of knowing that Buddha nature permeates all things and abiding within that. That all things interpenetrate and interpermeate each other. That Buddha nature and all things are not two different things. There aren't even two things to interpermeate. As Thich Nhat Hanh put it, all things inter-are. There is no inside or outside, for we're literally inside each other. We are inside each other. And what would the world be like if we really grasped that? So I would suggest, more strongly than suggest, that it's the job of the contemplative to dwell continually within non-duality, listening to listening. And this non-duality implies inclusiveness, right? So one can understand why my master wouldn't want to exclude anyone from the temple. So from within non-duality, what is it that a contemplative knows? A contemplative knows the natural state of the mind, heart. The natural state of the mind, heart, which is clear, bright awareness. Now, Ajahn Chah calls this stillness, which I find interesting. Stillness is the natural state of the mind, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary we might be able to amass. He adds, interestingly enough, Reverend Master Shiko read this a quote from him during her retreat, in which he says, and I'm not quoting him, that so are the four Brahma-viharas, the natural state of the mind. The four Brahma-viharas are loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. This is what we naturally are. Isn't that wonderful? All you have to do is let it show. Allow it to show. Now, I would venture to add, this may be heretical, I would venture to add that this is what the universe naturally is. The contemplative knows that the universe, from the smallest atom to the most complex creature, to the universe itself, is and always has been intelligent, alive, creative, and spiritual. The whole universe lives the divine, lives Buddha. Everything we are immersed in is living Buddha. So the poem that I read that first bit to you ends with, "The One is everything. Everything is the One. Trust and the heart are not two separate things. The not two is the heart that trusts to the eternal." However, there's a glitch. The not two, non-duality, itself can in a split second, a nanosecond, become an opposite. If there's non-duality, there must also be duality, right? This is the trouble you get into with Zen over and over and over again, which the practice of Zen keeps trying to shoot us through like an arrow shot from a bow. You know, you got to go straight through it or the whole problem's going to arise again. So then what does the contemplative do? She or he returns to the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. Now, those of you who are familiar with the 10 ox-herding pictures will recognize this as the caption for the last picture. The ox-herding pictures are a series of 10 drawings that depict the spiritual journey from its roughest beginning to ultimate realization. And it doesn't stop at enlightenment. Enlightenment's somewhere around 8 and 9. And the 10th one, which is beyond enlightenment, is returning to the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. So the contemplative returns to the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands, dwelling within non-duality. This isn't lay or monastic. It's about bringing an end to suffering for all beings. So welcome to the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives.